We'd heard for years about the tough economic times in newspapers. We also knew that the bulge of baby boomers would retire from their ink-stained jobs at those newspapers at some point. But it sure seemed like the passing of a generation when Paul Fadig retired from the Mail Tribune in Medford a few years ago. His byline on news articles and columns had appeared in the Daily Courier in Grants Pass, then the Mail Tribune in Medford for decades. So what's Paul Fadig been doing? Writing books, it turns out, including a recent publication melding some of his journalism and life experiences with the building of a new home in the woods. That's called Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. Paul, good to see you again.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Absolutely good to have you. You got deep roots in Southern Oregon. Your siblings and father all born here in Oregon, worked for newspapers in Alaska, California, and Oregon, and retired from the Mail Tribune just a few years ago.
That's true. At the end of 2013, it seems like decades ago now.
I did not realize how far back your journalism career went. So you actually began working for the Illinois Valley News while you were in high school?
I did in, 1967 for a fellow named Bob Grant, who was both the publisher and editor. And he was a kind of a lovable curmudgeon, great guy, and a wicked sense of humor.
Was he the kind of guy who challenged you when you first came in the door asking for a job? Like, what do you want?
Yes, yes. And he's the one that turned to his wife after I had walked down there during the lunch break, and I had kind of a reputation for being, let's say, a little bit rowdy, and as a high school kid. So the kid who was working at IV News had left, and I knew there was an opening, and there was not very many jobs in the Illinois Valley, so I went down there during this lunch break. And after pestering Bob and his wife Jan for about 40 minutes, I said, listen, I've got to get back to school. Are you going to hire me or not? And he turned to Jan and said, he's a persistent little, I guess I can say SOB, can
sure,
I?
Yeah,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's a persistent little SOB, isn't he? He turned back to me and said, come down here after school and we'll see how it works out. And it worked out great for a couple of years.
Really? A couple of years while you were still in high school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He was a good guy and I liked working for him.
And then off to the University of Oregon for
well, driving. Actually, I joined the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got it, and I did virtually nothing in the Marine Corps. I like to tell people that I fought hangovers for their freedom. Bad joke. Anyway, so when I got out, I went to University of Oregon and graduated with a degree in journalism.
So. Yeah, all right. So yeah, good point to bring up here that you were in the Marine Corps and you were in Vietnam, just not at the same time.
I was in Vietnam. You've read the book.
I have.
I was not in Vietnam while I was in the Corps, but I went there as a journalist in a very interesting country. All three of my brothers, that would be Jim, Charles, and George, were in Vietnam while in the Army.
Really? Okay. You point out, too, that while you were wounded, while you were a Marine, you were not wounded by being in the Marines.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I was celebrating with a couple of friends, and I flipped my Volkswagen Bug and broke my neck.
What did it do to you?
It was a great learning experience. It also made me a quadriplegic, and I spent almost a year in the hospital learning how to walk again. And again, it was a very valuable learning experience, which I would not ever repeat.
So, wow. So from there, you went to the University of Oregon. So Marine Corps,
right.
In the hospital, then onto the University of Oregon, into the journalism career.
Right.
Was journalism what you were destined for? You just kind of had the bug from school?
Yeah. As a kid growing up in Kirby, Kirby's halfway between Grants Pass and the state line, we didn't have a television, and my dad was an avid reader, so I became an avid reader. And so I was always interested in reading and writing and books and whatever. But as a kid growing up in Kirby, you'd never want to let your pals know that you read a lot. That was a secret.
Hmm. Not the kind of thing you wanted
to do. We were ruffians, and you just didn't display that sort of light behavior. So anyway, when I got out of the Corps and got in school, I knew immediately what I wanted to do. So, no question.
Did it for a long time. The prologue of the book, Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, is funny and serious all at once. I mean, the idea of explaining print journalism to young people is an interesting task, even imagined.
Right, mm-hmm. right. the upcoming generation, I think, has some great attributes. But I do I'm a little concerned that they may not be quite as well read as they could be. I'm not sure if the digital world. Geez, I'm talking like an old geezer. I'm not sure if the digital world is quite as fulfilling in a lot of regards as sitting down with a book and reading. But that's just my bias.
Do you hold out the hope that people will read longer material once they've read a lot of shorter material?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, I also subscribe to what's called slow journalism now, mm-hmm. Where you spend more time poring over something and studying it, and don't use sort of the fast food approach to reading and gaining knowledge.
But so a lot longer, deeper stuff, and not just the constant. You're not a guy who's going to be found on Twitter. It sounds like
no, mm-hmm. no. When I was my last newspaper job, they hounded me for several years to be a Twitter person, and I just never did. Ever, and they quit hounding me.
All right, before we get to a break, I want to point out that this is not just a book about you. We're clear from the start that there are two seats in this cockpit. Would you give us a quick sketch on Maureen, your wife?
My wife, Maureen. When I was in high school, I met her at 5:30 p.m. It could have been 5:36 p.m. on April 6, 1968, and I was forever smitten, still am. She's a wonderful lady with a great sense of humor. To put up with me is quite a achievement, actually. When I joined the Marine Corps, we went our separate ways and both became married to other people. And about 26 years ago, we got back together and raised a melded family. And all our kids are doing very well, and we got a great marriage.
All kinds of great stories in the book, Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. That would be Paul Fadig, Long of the Mail Tribune in Medford. And we'll come back and talk more with Paul. And you can join the conversation by phone or email when we return in a minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Paul Fadig, longtime writer and columnist for the Mail Tribune in Medford and many newspapers between Oregon and California and Alaska before that. He is a native of Southern Oregon and writes about his experiences growing up here, living here, reporting here, and refurbishing a cabin in the Applegate Valley. The book is called Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I do really like that, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. You're never quite cured, right?
That's right. You're always on the edge of falling off the wagon. It's a tough afterlife after journalism, but.
Have you gotten any post-retirement calls? I mean, anybody from the Mail Tribune say, hey, you want to contribute to the Our Valley segment or any one of our special things?
A couple of here and there, but largely I've sort of become a hermit on mm-hmm. Sterling Creek. When I retired, I worked on a Saturday. Sunday morning, I got up and started working on the book. And one thing I did learn in it at the university was if you're going to write about something, write about what you know about. I think that's a good that's good advice. At that point, I was no longer a journalist. I wasn't going out and asking folks questions and that sort of thing. So I'm a big fan of Peter Maley, who wrote A Year in Provence. And that book came out in the early 90s, New York Times bestseller. Great book. And for the listeners, for those who don't know, it focuses on a stone house that he and his wife built, rebuilt, and restored in Provence, France. And the difference between my book and his, well, there's several. One is that he's a terrific writer, got a great sense of humor, and very witty fellow. So not having any of that, I I still decided to sort of tag along. And when they restored their house, it was a 200-year-old stone house. They found several Napoleonic coins.
Wow.
Our house is a little under 100 years old and made of largely rotting logs. And we found a 1907 Indian head penny. So I guess my book is sort of the Southern Oregon answer to a year in Provence.
It's as close as you can come to an ancient structure in this civilization, I guess. Were you guys looking for a challenge when you bought this log cabin? Was it 16 years ago?
We were. It was in 2001. I gave a talk to a group recently, and one of the guys in the audience asked. I told him we were looking for land and an old house to restore. And so he raised his hand and he said, "Why?"
Great question.
It was a good question. I want to tell him, well, I'm just deeply disturbed, and people like us do these sort of silly things, but I didn't. We wanted the land because we wanted to get out and be able to walk on it and see the flowers and see the nature and whatever. And we wanted to explore the history of the area for a couple of reasons. One is that we're both avid history readers. And my grandparents, Jonas and Harriet Fadig, homesteaded in the Applegate. My dad was born here in Ashland in 1906. So we've got some family roots that we wanted to sort of follow. And when we saw this old place, we immediately fell in love. On the first day that I saw it, we walked around outside and I looked down at my feet and there was a broken part of a bottle that whose glass was purple. And that indicates that it came from 1800s, uh-huh. Generally. The color had been changed by the sun. So anyway, we immediately knew we wanted to restore that place. And so we did. It's still a work in progress.
Well, the concept of restore, I don't want to lead people astray. We're talking to Paul Fadig about his book, Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. So we know you live up Sterling Creek now. But the idea of restoring a cabin, this isn't just a renovation. What had happened to the cabin?
The cabin had been partially burned, about halfway burned, about 10, 12 years earlier, and hadn't been lived in since. The property owners had still retained the property. Unbeknownst to us, it had been on the market for almost a year when we happened by. And what happened is that Maureen and I were both working here in Medford, and so we ran out one day. We'd been looking for property for about 2 years. So during our lunch break, we ran out one day out there, and our friend and realtor, Pat, took us out there. And so we just had a few minutes to look at it, and the driveway is about 350 feet long, and we had to park the car at the highway because the driveway was overgrown, and we walked down to where the cabin was, and Pat walks into the door that's sort of hanging ajar, and she says, "Oh, my God, I can't show you this place," and turned around, and both Maureen and I said, no, hold it, we want to see this place. So we looked at it for maybe all of 15 minutes and then had to race back to work. So that evening we were driving home, and we at that point we had a house in Williams, which is about 30 miles out in the other end of the Applegate. And Maureen said, "Well, how did you like that place on Sterling Creek?" I said, "Well, I love that land, and I think that old cabin has some real potential." She said, "Yeah, so did I." And I said, "Well, what should we do?" She said, "Well, I talked to Pat, and she said we should make an offer." And so I did. I said, "Really?" "Yeah." And she said, "We offered, they wanted, okay, I can't remember, $160,000 or something." And she said, "We offered $116,000. And this is for this old cabin and 44 acres. And I said, well, what was their counter? And she said, they didn't counter. And I started saying, well, geez, you know, let's offer again and, you know, up it a little bit. And she said, no, they didn't counter. They accepted. And then suddenly we were sort of dumbfounded because we suddenly have a place that we'd only seen for 15 minutes or so. And so it went.
You land Baron for $116,000. It's a great deal. But I mean, as you got a closer look at the place for more than just the 15 minutes that you had with it already, I mean, what kind of a challenge did it present to you?
Oh, there was a toilet in the backyard. There was there had been another cabin right behind that cabin, but it had burned down. And we called that the mystery cabin. There was the guy had put these septic tank underneath the deck, which is not an ideal situation, but there was no electricity. It was in shambles, to say the least.
Paul Fadig is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. He worked for a long time at the Mail Tribune in Medford and the Daily Courier in Grants Pass, and papers going back years in California and Alaska as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760. And we can also take your emails at jx@jeffnet.org. Not quite clear on the name. It looks like Dairy in Salem. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Fadig.
Hey, Paul Fadig. This is Gary Earle. How are you?
Hi, Gary.
I haven't talked to you in about 35 years.
Last time I talked to you, you were about 4 years old.
Hey, I had a question about that area out there. Are you guys finding anything that would suggest that, you know, there was the Chinese were there with the miners, or because you said about the Indian head, but is there any artifacts you're finding that, you know, date back to when the Chinese were mining in Southern Oregon?
You know, we found a number of things. We found an obsidian scraper that indicates indigenous folks were there eons before the European Americans were. We do have two adits up on the upper end of our property. One I was foolish enough to crawl into.
That's told in the book. It was Damien Mann from the Mail
Tribune. Right, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And that was entirely Damien Mann's fault. I want the world to know this.
Damien may be listening, so I get another phone call soon.
I'm going to digress for just a second. What happened with that was I had wanted to go into that adit. And
an adit is what now for the folks?
An adit is a horizontal shaft, basically. And it looks like a hobbit hole, this particular one. It's about 4.5 feet high and circular. And no bracing timbers inside. And so an archaeologist friend of mine, Jeff Leland, suspects it was either, and he hadn't been to it, but just from his knowledge of the area, and he has vast knowledge, suspected it could have been dug in by the Chinese or even a little bit later. So that, to answer your question, Gary, I'm not sure if the Chinese were in that area. I know that Jin Lin had a mine a couple of miles down Sterling Creek, near Sterling Creek, and on the Little Applegate. So he would have been through that area, and certainly the Chinese miners would have been in that region. But going back to that adit, I wanted to go look at it, and I told Damien about it, and he was all excited. And so he arrives one morning, and Damien's about 6'4 or something. He's like a big kid, according to my wife. And if you're listening, Damien, that's meant as a positive. But anyway, so he arrives one morning, and he has a miner's lamp on the whole bit, and he's all excited about going up to check out the adit. And, of course, we promised Marine we would not go in there, of course, and we were fibbing. So anyway, so we go up there, and we go in we get to the entrance, and to get in, you have to sort of crawl in the dirt into this hole. And so I go in. Damien, who'd been talking about his excitement to get into that area, went about 4 feet in, and that was as far as he was going. He announced at that point he had a little touch of claustrophobia. So I go back about 150 feet or whatever, 140 feet, to the very end where it's left off. And Damien is sitting at the entrance, and he's starting to pick the rock off the ceiling and announces that it's real, real shaley. And I yelled a couple of bad words and told him to stop and scurried out. And that was the only time I've ever been in there. And anyway, well, I didn't find any anything in there that indicated that who had built it, whether it was Chinese or other folks. Later, a retired geology professor, Jad DeLira, from SOU, went up to the outside of the adit with me, and he also admonished me that that was not a smart thing to do, to crawl in there, and it wasn't. But again, that was all Damon's fault.
Here, let me give you the book from our previous guest. It's about risk, and you probably want to read about this.
Yes,
I'm going to go
yeah.
in the adits again.
We're
talking to Paul Fadig here on the Jefferson Exchange. Gary in Salem, thanks so much for your call. Paul is a
longtime
Southern Oregon journalist, and he's written a book called Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. As I was reading the description of you and Damien Mann going into the adit on your property, I was remembering a couple of stories that I think we reported together when I was working as a TV reporter for the ABC affiliate in Medford, and it seems like the cave system near Grants Pass that the BLM took us into.
Marble Mountain Caves.
Right. Okay, yeah. So you were there that day. That was my recollection. It was the same kind of thing. We had to crawl through this narrow entrance and shove my equipment through, and then lug it all around on the inside.
Oh, I was petrified in there. I didn't want to tell you that, but oh my God.
Well, this is part of the life of being a journalist, though.
True.
You get to go see and do some interesting things, and you get to see and do some pretty hairy things as well.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about that trip, that was about 20 years ago.
Yeah, at least.
There was a BLM person there whose name I won't mention, but nice enough guy. But I'd known him for a couple of years, and he was very closed-mouthed, wasn't very talkative at all.
Mm-hmm.
But he apparently was a caver.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got inside there, he became this really loquacious fellow. It was the strangest thing. And then when he got back on the surface, he was closed-mouthed again.
Interesting. But that's one of the things, too, about the business is you get to meet all these interesting personality types. You get to learn a lot about humanity. But I wonder, though, about that part of life as a journalist where you're always a generalist.
Mm-hmm.
You always know a little bit about a lot of things. Have you ever had any regrets about not learning a lot about anything? Or if you did, perhaps.
I have some regret in that regard. You know, I always wanted to be an archaeologist. If it weren't for the hard science classes and that kind of thing, I probably could have done fairly well in there.
Hmm. Oh, except for those things, physics and all the stuff you need to know to make buildings not collapse on you. So that brings us back to buildings collapsing. So, how long did it take? Just give us a sense of the time stretch just from taking possession of this property in the valley to actually being able to spend the night in the structure.
Well, one thing, going back to being a journalist, you get to know a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, I knew a couple guys who were who restored old structures. A fellow named Chris Bratt and Richard Goodenow, both excellent carpenters. And I'd known Chris in part because of his environmental activities.
He was part of the Applegate Partnership.
Absolutely.
In the
early days, wasn't it? Very intelligent guy and a very interesting guy. His nephew is Ben Bratt, the actor.
I did not realize they were related until I read that in the book.
In fact, when they were restoring the cabin, I told Chris that anytime his nephew Benjamin and his girlfriend Julia Roberts wanted to come visit, that'd be fine. But they never did. I think if they would have, it would have survived. You know, their relationship would have survived the pressures of Hollywood. But anyway, so Richard and Chris and another fellow named Paul Tipton, who is also an excellent carpenter, all helped us. Well, they were the folks that did the main work. Maureen and I did the sheetrock and lots of other work. We peeled logs with draw knives and the whole bit. Great experience.
Except for the fact that a knife is actually pointing toward you. You draw it toward yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And you you remove a lot of skin on your knuckles when you use a draw knife. It's pretty hard work. And the logs that we had were dry. These were fir logs. And as a result, the bark was very resistant to coming off. If it's a green, if it's green timber, it's much easier.
All right, we'll talk much more about the process of fixing up this cabin and some more recollections from a career in journalism. A lot of it spent in Southern Oregon. Paul Fadig is a Southern Oregon native and is living on a log cabin up Sterling Creek now. It's the book is called Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. We'll come back and talk more with Paul and take some more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a chat here with Paul Fadig, who is a bit of a journalistic legend in Southern Oregon. He is born and raised in Southern Oregon, deep roots in the area, grew up in Kirby, went to Illinois Valley High School, left for a while for the Marine Corps, went to the University of Oregon, worked at newspapers in Alaska and California, and then in Grants Pass, and retired from the Mail Tribune in Medford after a long career there. So his columns and byline known to generations of readers, essentially, in Southern Oregon. He's written a book now called Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, about the whole process of finding and restoring a log cabin on Sterling Creek in the Applegate Valley. The book is subtitled Confessions of a Recovering Journalist, because, you know, once you're a journalist, you never actually get over it. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about some of the people that helped you with the cabin in the Applegate Valley, and I want to talk about the Applegate Valley a little more broadly here, because we get lots of guests from there, and there's obviously a special sort of community in the Applegate Valley, and it's also the place where it seems to be the birth of lots of interesting forestry projects, new ways to be able to, A, get timber out of forests, and, B, leave the forest intact with the likes of people like Chris Bratt, supporting this over the years.
That's absolutely true. You know, and looking at the other side, if there's another side, we had Paul Kangas, who was a retired forester for the BLM. He came out and did some work on our forest to sort of study to tell us the health of the forest, that kind of thing. And I'm, you know, Paul and Chris have a lot in common. I don't know if they'd admit it either to each one. You know, both of them have a lot of knowledge about those issues. And I think the Applegate Valley has an eclectic community, a very diverse group of people. And for the most part, I think, you know, wherever they are on the political spectrum, they seem to largely get along, which I appreciate.
Sounds good. So did you, there are a couple of comparisons in the book here between you and Forrest Gump. Where does that come from? You're a little smarter, I think.
I'm not sure about that. I've had a wonderful life. And in part because I sort of bump into people in the strangest, weirdest ways. For instance, this cabin, the only time I've ever talked to the President of the United States was right up behind our cabin. That was President Bush the II.
And I guess, yeah, you would have owned the place at that time, wouldn't you?
We did.
Yeah.
And we'd only been there. See, that was in August of 2002, so we'd only been there a little over a year. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we were still living in a trailer. And if I recall, the toilet in the back was still sitting there. I'm not sure if we'd moved it out
the,
yet.
The toilet has a big chunk of this book, I should point
I
out.
Really
it shows
wished
up over and over again.
I wished I would have taken a photo of it. It was quite remarkable as, you know, as toilets go. I'm not fixated on it or anything. It was just a strange thing to be sitting there. But anyway, so I did end up talking to Mr. Bush. He had come west to see what was in the biggest fire in the nation, the Biscuit Fire. And his folks decided that it was too dangerous for him to go there, so they shunted him off to look at the Squires Peak Fire, which had caused us to evacuate at one point. It wasn't on our land, but it was on our neighbor's land at one point.
Too close for comfort, anyway.
Yeah. And so he came there, and I talked to him just briefly. I was part of the group of regional journalists that got to tag along with him.
You got to be a pool reporter that day?
I did. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. And actually, he turned out to be a very personable fellow. Mm-hmm. You know, regardless of what you think of his politics, he was an interesting character.
But the interesting description of the moment, too, when he was like, Mr. President, he turns to you and says, yes.
Yes. But see, as a journalist, you become, I don't want to use the term prostitute, but I can't think of a better word at this point. But anyway, no reflections on journalists out there. You kind of know what's necessary to get your foot in the door. And that day, there was the White House press corps with them, and they were firing questions. There was a guy on my left, if I recall, who asked about some sort of corruption scandal back in around the White House. Geez, that's hard to imagine. And anyway, and President Bush said, you know, we'll deal with that when we get back. And the lady on my right, I think she's from CNN, asked him about some sort of a scandal involving President Mubarak of Egypt. And basically he said, we'll get to that when we get back. We'll deal with that when we get back to the White House. And so I knew he was here to talk about forestry issues. Mm-hmm. So my hand shot up. It was like the guy in Dr. Strangelove, you know, the arm shooting up. You can't control it. And I found myself yelling, Mr. President, getting back to the forestry issue. And he turned to me and said, yes. And then I asked some probably very sophomoric question, but he answered it at length. And I felt almost 5'10".
Which is a bit of a change from usual. Paul Faddick's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, longtime journalist in Southern Oregon. His book is Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. Here's another call from Salem. There must be a lot of people calling from one house. Patrick, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Pat.
Well, I got to tell you, that book was a pleasure to read, and congratulations on it.
Well, thank you, and I'll send you that money I promised a little later.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if that $20 was still on for the pit. You know, you started off the program, you were mentioning, talking about those newfangled electronics and how you felt like an old geezer.
Mm-hmm.
That might be because you might be an old geezer. I've known you since the fifth grade.
That's true. It's also because I'm somewhat of a Luddite, but we won't go there. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, I guess my big question is, from the start to the finish, not just, but even for your life, but there are those last 10 years there in that cabin. Do you see your life philosophy? Has it changed any? Did it change you? Did it make you more mellow? What can you say that your life lesson that you've learned from that ordeal?
Wow.
And that's the best way I can describe it. I've been in it, and I know the work you did, and that's just, it staggers. It makes me tired thinking about it.
Thanks for the story and the question, Patrick.
Thanks, Pat. You know, Jeff, I thought there weren't going to be any hard questions.
What?
You know, for the audience, I should let you know that Pat and I did go through Kirby Elementary School and high school together. We were on the wrestling team, and Pat's also a former Marine and a retired police officer. Yeah, I think it did change me. I'm probably a little bit more patient, although my wife would question that. But I think every corner that you turn in life changes you a little bit. you have more mileage. Your teeth are a little longer. You suffer from incontinence. I'm just joking. Just kidding. But anyway, it changes you. And I think you grow to appreciate every day. Getting back to this cabin, it has so much history in it. There was a fellow named James Mason Hutchins who came through Sterlingville in 1855, February of 1855. And this was about 7 or 8 months after gold was discovered on Sterling Creek and Sterlingville mushroomed up. And anyway, he wrote about that area. The place where we live was known as the Gilson Ranch, and it was homesteaded in 1870 by Thomas and Alice Gilson, who raised 10 children there. So as you go through life and you learn these things about where you live and about the people who preceded you, you gain a certain appreciation for having the privilege to live there.
How big a place is it? We haven't talked about the size of this cabin and bedrooms and
it's
that stuff.
2-bedroom, 2-bath. It's part log and part lumber. It's about a little under 1,600 square feet.
Mm-hmm. So it's okay for one man, one woman, and 10 cats?
Cats and 2 large hairy dogs.
what was the line in the book, hair is a condiment in our
house? Yes, we floss with it.
Oh, yeah. Yikes.
I don't mind cat hair that much anymore.
Well, when you live with pets, I guess that's what you're going to happen. I did have a couple other questions about the things in your journalism career. And curiously, to come back to the presidential visit of George W. Bush, I mean, we live in a state in Oregon where the attorney general sometimes returns phone calls directly to you. I mean, I've had the governor call phone numbers without having a person say, please hold for the governor. I mean, people call you in the state of Oregon. So I wonder how different that was to deal with a national figure like the president and all the layers of people you have to go through and people calling you from the Secret Service and asking for your information in advance and all that.
Yeah, that was quite interesting. When I worked up in Anchorage, I remember one time I was doing a feature story, something on Alaska, and wanted to talk to the governor and found out that he was having lunch across the street at the Captain Cook Hotel. So I just sauntered over and talked to him. That's Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's wonderful. Down here in the lower 48, you're right. In Oregon, you have quite a bit of access to public figures, but President of the United States, totally different. I mean, it's...
Yeah, we're talking about somebody who represents 300 million people as opposed to the slightly more than 4 in Oregon now.
Right, right.
Yeah, different kind of situation. Is there one story in your career in 3 states that stands out above all the others, one thing you covered or one incident on the way to covering a story that rises above all others in your memory?
Oh, gosh. There was a fellow that I interviewed up in the Arctic named Waldo Bodfish. And I was doing a story on the Dew Line. That's a distant early warning.
To know if missiles were coming from Russia.
Right. And I don't think it's no longer working, but that was back in June of 1984. And so I go up there to this village of Wainwright and... people would not talk to me because I was an outsider, and I can understand their reluctance, actually. So I walked out to the cemetery, and this was during, again, in June, and it was a 24-hour daylight, and I noticed there was this elderly gentleman standing on the other side of the cemetery who had a large olive drab parka on and was carrying these... binoculars that were obviously from World War II or something. But anyway, and he had white hair, and I waved, and he waved back. And I thought, well, that's a good sign. So I go over and started chatting with him. And turns out he was sort of the village patriarch, and his name was Waldo Bodfish, who was the son of a Captain Bodfish from Martha's Vineyard, who had a relationship with one of the Native folks up there, and Waldo was the product. And at that point, Waldo was in his 80s, and he told me that he once was a village dentist by virtue of having a pair of pliers.
Ooh.
That's a little bit worse than it was in Kirby when I was a kid. But anyway, a very nice guy, very bright guy, and great sense of humor. And I just thought, wow, that I just love meeting people like that. And that's precisely why I became a journalist.
Well, so gripping tales and interesting people and some great characters along the way, but also the mundane tasks like the court beat, you know, and who died overnight and, you know, whose house burned down and all that sort of stuff. So on balance, I mean, do you miss it much or had you pretty had your fill?
I really, any journalist I worked with would tell you that I hated to go to car wrecks, hated to do the, you know, I did a, one night in the East Bay area, I did a murder-suicide, wrapped up that story, and then did another murder. And at that point, I had had it. I just could not stand covering issues like that. I want to be a journalist to find out about people do what they do, and I'm not talking about why they murder each other.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, all right. So, back to the, we just have a couple seconds left now. Mm-hmm. The theme of the fate of the business, the Mail Tribune, your former employer and its sister, the Daily Tidings of Ashland, just sold again. Do you worry about the future of some of the smaller newspapers?
I do. I enjoyed my time at the Trib, and very much worried. I'm not sure the digital world would be quite as interesting, but maybe it will be. I'm a Luddite, so that's...
Well, we will get a chance to see. Lots of observations from Paul Fadding in the book Up Sterling Creek Without a Paddle, Confessions of a Recovering Journalist. A pleasure to see you again. Thanks for visiting.
It was good seeing you, Jeff.